This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's political GabFest, raising taxes, enhancing revenues, closing loopholes, whatever you call it, we'll discuss whether Washington is on the verge of doing it. Then, you think this president's got problems? A new movie reminds us how Lincoln dealt with his do-nothing Congress.
I am the president of the United States of America. Clothed in immense power.
I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the retirement of Philip Roth sparked a debate between us over when it's time for great artists to hang it up. And then what happens when louts invade the Amtrak quiet car? Plus, it's the restaurant review that ate Manhattan. The New York Times has massively panned this guy's new eatery.
The place and the food are both off the hook.
It all starts with the political GabFest right after the news.
Hello, and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate, WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. On this week's program, we'll discuss taxes and the fiscal cliff, and in particular, the Republican pledge to Grover Norquist, the pledge that many Republicans have signed not to raise taxes and how that relates to the reality of the fiscal cliff. Then, what can President Obama or any other Washington politicians learn from Steven Spielberg's new movie about Abraham Lincoln? And of course, we'll have cocktail chatter. Joining me in Washington are Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
In the past 20 years, not a single Republican senator or representative has voted to raise a penny in federal taxes. Never. Not one. There are many reasons for this. Ideologically, conservative members of Congress just don't think government should get more revenue. And they think that one good way to control government spending is to freeze the amount of money coming into the federal government. And there are other reasons, but one key one is what's called the pledge, a document signed by the vast majority of Republican federal elected officials, as well as candidates committing never to vote for tax increase. The pledge is the brainchild of a person whose name everyone has heard. I don't know him. John, you probably know him. Grover Norquist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who is one of the most successful and feared and admired and loathed
Svengali-like
Washington figures. But the pledge is under some serious pressure this week as Republicans try to figure out how to maneuver around the fiscal cliff, how to make a deal with President Obama, or whether to make a deal with President Obama to resolve the issue of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, which are scheduled to expire on January 1st. There's all kinds of jockeying, all kinds of maneuvering. Emily, is there any way for Republicans to cut a deal with President Obama, who's determined to raise taxes on the wealthy, without, quote, raising taxes?
I suppose the answer technically could be yes, if they closed all the loopholes or they capped all your tax exemptions at $18,000 or $25,000, that idea that's still floating around from the Mitt Romney campaign. And then they could kind of claim that they're not raising taxes, even though they're raising revenue. I think myself that it's really a sleight of hand, and that the really devious part of this pledge is that we should have everything on the table and just figure out what the most fiscally sensible way is to deal with revenue and the deficit, rather than playing these games, because Grover Norquist is such a mastermind at getting people to sign cheap and stupid statements.
Yeah. So I think the one way that everybody could be, and this is something I've been feeling is more likely to be the case more than ever, is basically we go over the quote unquote fiscal cliff, which I prefer Ezra Klein's phrase, the austerity crisis, because it's not a cliff. And what it really is it's like, I mean, what we're basically trying to do here is, instead of going on an immediate starvation diet, which will eventually be so destructive that it harms the body, they want to replace the starvation diet with like a Weight Watchers diet, which is a kind of the same austerity but played out over a longer period of time, more intelligently apportioned, and with everybody on board, so that everybody feels like, you know, always good to go through a diet with someone rather than by yourself. What could happen, though, is we go over the cliff, the taxes go up for everyone, and then everybody gets to vote for a tax cut. In the solution bill, in the ultimate big solution, everybody then is voting for a tax cut, which obviously wouldn't cut rates for the people at the top. But they would all be voting for a tax cut, and that would get them around the Norquist pledge. Republicans don't want to be in that position, though, either, because then they will have done two things. They will have gone over the cliff, gotten blamed for that, and they'll be in a weaker position because essentially the president will then be able to say, look, I've got a bill here that will reduce taxes for 98% of the country. People will be feeling the pain of the tax increase. It'll be taken out of their paychecks. And he'll say they're only blocking this relief measure because of 2% of the country.
The Republicans have an incentive to move now.
The Bush tax cuts, one way that you could get around the
incentive to move now, don't they then have to violate this pledge?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about violating the pledge, I mean, there are two ways. You can do it Emily's way, except the president has said he won't do it Emily's way, essentially, that you can't get the revenue from closing loopholes on the wealthy alone to fill this problem.
I don't think he said he won't do it that way. He said this is insufficient, right? You could do some of it this way. It's just not going to get you all the way there.
Right. But he's saying it's insufficient, which is to say where taxes are going to still go up on the wealthy. The thing about the pledge is, I mean, Grover Norquist is powerful and he's sort of assiduous in sticking on the pledge. The pledge is backed up by voters who are in the Republican primary process. They're the ones who vote for Richard Murdoch over Richard Lugar. Grover Norquist isn't lining everybody up at the ballot box and forcing them to vote for more conservative members. So Norquist's power is being able to use sentiment within the conservative movement in the Republican Party. We know about Norquist. Not every Republican primary voter knows about Norquist. They do know about taxes. They do know that taxes shouldn't be increased. They think that Ronald Reagan, in the romantic vision of the party, they think that Ronald Reagan never raised taxes, that it is a core. There are a couple of core things you believe in this kind of romantic notion that's bigger than Grover Norquist. It's that Ronald Reagan did no wrong and that taxes should never increase. And those romantic views are what I think is super controlling, and Norquist is very, very, very good at marshaling that sentiment, channeling it, and using it to control people.
If the pledge itself is a sideshow, a sidelight to the actual fundamentals of the issue, why does it come up so often? Why is it that...
Well, because a lot of people think that Republicans are captive merely to the pledge, and that if you could just remove that one pin, reasonableness would flow. And I think that overstates the case. I think that the pledge is a part of a much longer or larger thing.
And maybe the pledge is like shorthand for, oh, Republicans are captive to this inside the beltway guy and his way of thinking. And John's point is that, no, they're captive to their constituency.
Right. It isn't because some Washington lobbyist says you can't raise taxes. They're not raising taxes. They're doing it because it's part of a set of ideological beliefs about it. But I'm enough of a school of behavioral economics to think that setting ground rules, framing the game, setting up the rules of the game, and that means putting in something like this pledge, actually has a meaningful effect on people's behavior. Absent the pledge, there would have been historically a few Republicans who would have voted for various tax measures over the past 22 years.
I don't know. It is the kind of tip of a spear that the rest of the spear is what's actually driving it. It's the instrument for driving that power in the Republican Party. And what's interesting, you know, overthrowing the pledge will be sort of the last interesting thing of what's going to happen with the Republicans, which interesting is how they choose to do it, who comes on board, how many people and who, you know, how many Republicans end up voting for tax increases of some kind, whether the rates increase or whether it's a reduction in loopholes.
So if a deal happens before January 1st, what are the outlines of it likely to be? And how do Republicans spin it and say this isn't tax increase?
Yeah. Well, this is what's – I don't know what the outlines are because I think it's so confusing. I think that they do – I don't see how Republicans vote for a tax increase, a marginal tax rate increase. And the president is basically saying
– you have to do it.
You have to do it. I mean, that is the big –
right. So it's –
that's the problem. But it seems to me that I think a smart Republican says it's worse for us if this doesn't happen.
Wait, if what doesn't happen?
If we don't make some kind of deal now. Because come January, we'll be getting kind of double. We'll not only have gotten blamed for going over the cliff, but we'll also be in a position where our negotiating hand isn't strengthened.
Don't they also, once they get to that have that moment, John, then does it make sense for dozens of them to join hands and all take the jump together so that then there are too many of them for Grover Norquist to come after?
Yeah, I'm still in my sort of post-Norquist phase, which is to say I'm thinking about the other motivations these folks have, which is about primaries and also about their future. And the motivation that's on my mind now is that if you look at the Republicans trying to run for president in 2016, if there is a Republican who feels like they want to grab this patch of ground that shows that they're the kind of moderate new age Republican, they might be able to confect a storyline for themselves where they can play a role here. And I'm not sure what that role is, but there are a lot of people out there waiting. You know, they've got their costume on and they're just waiting to rush out on stage at the right moment. And all of that, it's wonderful. It's fantastic. It's what makes politics so great. Is there are a lot of, they're like 16 of them backstage, and one of them's going to rush. And when they do, the others will either decide, let him go on his own, or they'll normally do what they do, which is rush out after them. So you could have this group of Republicans trying to find some kind of solution that just will be interesting. But I don't know when that happens.
All right. Let's leave it there. We will find out in the next few weeks what the outcome will be, and it will be exciting. Coming up, Steven Spielberg's Lincoln and whether it speaks to today's politics. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson. And this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. So Steven Spielberg's Lincoln arrived in movie theaters this week. It is not a straight biopic, although it is certainly has lots of biographical elements in it. It's certainly as hagiographic as any biopic could ever hope to be. It focuses on a few months in early 1865 when Lincoln tried to push the 13th Amendment through a House of Representatives where he did not have the, or did not appear to have the two-thirds majority he needed to get this amendment passed. He needed to buy votes, push, lobby, blackmail, all while sort of managing his own rebellious cabinet, taking care of his family and its fractures, its emotional fractures. And, of course, supervising the last days of the Civil War and the victory over the South. So we all saw the movie. And, John, I'm interested. You're a Lincolnologist and an amateur historian. What were you most struck by there?
Amateur being the key word. I was struck by the scope of the film. I mean, it's got so much in it, and I found I thought the most powerful things were the dramas that Lincoln, Sally Field as Mary Todd Lincoln, who I thought Sally Field was amazing, really, really, really good. Daniel Day-Lewis is the way he carries his feet, the way he walks. I mean, we obviously didn't see Lincoln walking, but it feels so right. Those labored footsteps of a 6'4" man when I'm spoiling some of this for people, but. What the hell?
He dies.
When he lays down next to his son in front of the fire, it's just you feel really a part of that film. I thought all of that was great. What didn't work as well for me was it's essentially a movie about getting enough votes to pass the 13th Amendment. I felt like the vote counting part of it was not as good as the rest of it. But I did love the one of the larger points of the film, which is that basically every president feels besieged and they think, but Lincoln was besieged too, and look how it all turned out for him. And capturing that, I thought was quite well done. But I don't want to keep going on. Emily, what'd you think?
Well, I kept seeing the movie through the lens of this incredibly deep strain of pragmatism that was basically governing every move that Lincoln made. And he even got other people around him to buy into it. So one of my favorite scenes was Thaddeus Stevens, who's the leader of the Radical Republicans. In that moment in time, that meant being an abolitionist and also believing in race equality as well as equality under the law. But Stevens knows that if he says that publicly in the chamber at this key vote counting moment, that he's going to lose. And so he finds this, you know, kind of clever rhetorical way, but really he just backs off this deep moral belief that he has. And then he gets berated for it afterward by a colleague. But you're so on the side of where he comes out, which is to say, he says, I'll say anything to get this bill passed right now. So I'm a pragmatist at heart, too. And so I was totally with him the whole way. And then I was talking about it with my kids after the movie because we took them to see it. And I was just wondering what effect that has on them to think that basically, like, any principle can be sacrificed in favor of passing the 13th Amendment because of this larger good. I wonder if there's any downside to that lesson.
Well, I thought just to give readers, viewers, a sense of this, there was...
Listeners, actually.
Listeners, sorry. I can't remember what medium I'm in. But there's this great scene that feels very current between where Thaddeus Stevens and President Lincoln are having debate. And Lincoln and Stevens is basically saying that his position, which is universal, not only universal suffrage for slaves, but also to take the lands of the Confederates in, or the South and the states that seceded, and basically just take it from them and give
reparations.
Them reparations. And Lincoln is much more deliberate, much more slow. And Stevens says, you know, that it says what he's doing is leadership, and that Lincoln should try it sometime. And the pace of leadership is obviously something we've talked about a lot about. And one of the claims for President Obama is he's too slow, too deliberative, doesn't know how to lead. But of course, one of Lincoln's great talents was slowness and delay. And yet in this movie, the whole point is he's in a hurry up mode. But so he and Stevens kind of come to a new understanding of what leadership is. And so Stevens, in the end, by taking the kind of Weasley approach, ends up getting what he wants or more of what he wants. You get half a loaf is better than no loaf at all.
One of the things I loved about this movie, particularly because it's such a stark contrast to how legislative debate happens now, and I actually don't know whether it's true to reality, is that there is almost British Parliament-like raucous legislative debate here.
How can I hold that all men are created equal when here before me stands stinking the moral carcass of the gentleman from Ohio, proof that some men are inferior, endowed by their maker with dim wits, impermeable to reason, with cold, pallid slime in their veins instead of hot red blood. You are more reptile than man, George. So low and flat that the foot of man is incapable of crushing you.
How dare you?
They're screaming at each
other. The floor of Congress, it is genuinely important what is being said on the floor of Congress, and they're listening to each other and fighting it out on the floor of Congress. Whereas today, if you even at the most heightened moments of legislative debate, there's nothing going on. Most people aren't even in the chamber. They don't bother to show up. It doesn't. There's never a sense that the stakes of what is actually spoken in Congress matters.
That's true. Although you can imagine certainly a big signature moment. I mean, during when health care was
counting
passed,
the health care bill was pretty good.
Yeah.
Drama.
Now here's the thing that I didn't like about that. I mean, this David, you're quite right. This is a drama in which even the Supreme Court, you don't see this in the film, but the justices of the Supreme Court came for the vote, and it was actually much more dramatic than the movie made it. When they finally did the vote, nobody knew who'd won. They announced the number, and there was total silence in the chamber. And it was only until the speaker read the formal vote and then said the amendment is agreed to, or whatever he said, that the room erupted. And men wept openly when this passed, those who supported it.
We asked our listeners to suggest topics for us to discuss. One subject that listeners were very interested in was the treatment of African-American characters. The African-American characters in the movie are mostly peripheral.
Minor grace notes.
They're passive. They play servant roles. And there's one interesting mistress who's African-American. But I was wondering what you guys thought of that. Was there a way to handle black characters differently that would have been historically true? Or did the movie do it as well as could be done?
Well, I thought it was important that the movie actually begins with a pretty powerful speech by a couple of black Union soldiers.
I thought that scene was so bad. I almost
really?
I was cringing.
It may be the worst
scene.
Opening scene of any great movie I've ever seen.
Totally.
But it was terrible for other reasons.
It wasn't their fault. It wasn't the actor's fault.
No.
It was like written badly.
And it was so contrived. Oh! Anyway, Emily,
okay.
Go ahead.
I totally concede the staginess of the scene. However, I did think it was important that at the beginning of the movie, you see black people making the most cogent argument for the 13th Amendment that you hear throughout the entire movie.
Just as a final thought, I thought that Daniel Day-Lewis's performance in this movie was as good a performance as I've ever seen in anything of any act. It was like watching Michael Jordan. I didn't like the movie all that much. I thought the movie was fine, but I thought his embodiment of Lincoln, we don't know whether this is really what Lincoln was like, but it's so persuasive. It is so full and rich, and this is a character I would like to have that guy over for dinner. Like the stories that this Lincoln tells and the way he tells them and the physical – his use of his body is
– it's a masterpiece.
Unbelievably great.
There is so much going on in every scene. I felt myself at times like totally losing the thread because I was so absorbed with his fully realized portrayal, which I just thought was – it was so good. It was almost outside the film.
Euclid's first common notion is this.
Things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other. That's a rule of mathematical reasoning. It's true because it works. You see, there it is, even in that 2,000-year-old book of mechanical law. It is a self-evident truth that things which are equal to the same thing are equal to each other.
Can I ask an historical question I'm still working on with this movie?
Briefly.
I can't get my mind around the idea that with, in this, almost the spring of 1865, with the South on its knees, General Sherman is marching, you know, to the sea, that people, so many politicians were really ready to let the South back into the Union without abolishing slavery. I mean, what was the whole point? I get that there were some people who were never in the North, who were never super committed to that idea. But I mean, honestly, that would have been totally crazy.
Well, this is one of the things I thought in the legislative dance could have been a little bit better explained, that for a lot of the Northern Democrats, it, like not only did they not want blacks free, but there was also a states' rights constitution thing that they'd convinced themselves of that didn't have, it was kind of different from slaves free or not free. I mean, there were a whole mess of different arguments that Lincoln was fighting against. I thought none of them. I mean, maybe there just wasn't space. I just thought there could have been a lot more explained along those lines.
All right. The movie is, of course, Lincoln. You should go see it. It's a great holiday movie, great movie to prompt discussion, make you think about our current political situation. All right. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are in a post-Thanksgiving stupor and you're attempting to make conversation about something other than turkey, what are you going to chatter to him about, Emily?
There's a story in The New Yorker this week by Victor Sapana, who is a writer I got to know a little bit when he was a Yale student. It's about his mother's conviction for shaken baby syndrome. It's very moving, and Victor is a wonderful writer who we will all be able to look forward to following.
JD, what's your chatter?
My chatter is that the Gallup Organization, which took a real pounding this election cycle, so we don't know if these numbers are true, but the Gallup Organization has figured out after polling people in 150 countries that Singaporeans are the least likely in the world to report experiencing emotions of any kind on a daily basis. So only 36% of those who live in Singapore report feeling either positive or negative emotions during the day. The United States, 54%. The Philippines.
Wait, so even half of Americans report feeling no emotion?
Yeah. I mean, again, this has got to be a polling thing more than anything else. They just like, of course they feel emotion. It's just they've decided in these five questions not to register it somehow.
That's awesome. I want to chatter about the new movie of Red Dawn. Red Dawn is a movie that came out when all of us were teenagers. It came out in 1984. It was this incredible World War III movie. It posits a Soviet-Cuban-Nicaraguan invasion of the United States and a plucky band of high school football players led by Patrick Swayze, a somewhat older kid, form a group of guerrillas resisting the Soviet occupation. And it's a really amazing movie that haunted my dreams. My only recurring nightmare as a child was of a Soviet helicopter gunship coming over a cliff and gunning for me, which is the kind of high point action scene of that original Red Dawn. But Red Dawn has been remade, and I will be going to see it, even though it sounds absolutely terrible, because they've replaced the Russians with North Koreans, which is just simply totally unpersuasive. And apparently the reason they've replaced the Russians with North Koreans is that they wanted to replace the Russians with Chinese, but they were just so afraid of offending Chinese sensibilities. But the idea that North Korea could land thousands of paratroopers in the United States does not seem credible.
No.
I will check it out. That's it for the political GabFest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of our show with more topics on our podcast. Search for Slate Political GabFest in iTunes. I'm David Plotz in Washington, relinquishing the microphone to Stephen in New York.
Thanks, David. I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture GabFest. On today's show, the greatest restaurant review of all time, full stop. And then we talk about retirement. When is it time to hang them up? And finally, the quiet car, civilization's last haven, or a tin can filled with persnickety snobs. Thank you, Dana. I haven't made you laugh in 2 years. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Julia, I should say, is coming to us remote from Slate's Boston bureau. Julia, how you doing?
Our Boston bureau, a.k.a. my parents' couch. I'm doing well. How are you?
Excellent. I'm doing quite well. Thank you. And our film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
All right. Well, diving right in. Guy Fieri, as I now understand it, I had never heard of him before. Dana, I'm not at all embarrassed to admit until this delicious episode. But he is a restaurateur, author, television personality, and game show host who owns kind of upscale themed chain restaurants, who made the mistake of opening one in Times Square that the New York Times restaurant critic Pete Wells wandered into, let's say, in the last couple of weeks. And Pete Wells proceeded to write truly one of the great, I mean, regardless of whether it's about a movie, a book, whatever the object under the fire of withering scorn is, he wrote one of the truly great sarcastic takedowns ever. Let me quote from it. I should say, by way of setting it up, the entire review is in the interrogatory mood, right? Every single sentence of it is a question posed to Guy Fieri, which you would think would get tiresome. It only builds and builds and builds and builds to this wonderful, you know, orgiastic crescendo in which he says, "Is the entire restaurant a very expensive piece of conceptual art? Is the shapeless, structureless baked Alaska that droops and slumps and collapses while you eat it or don't eat it supposed to be a representation in sugar and eggs of the experience of going insane?" Dana, this review went viral almost immediately to the point where Fieri was forced to appear on, I think, the Today Show to defend the restaurant against this assault. I have no idea what the quality of the restaurant is. I can tell you what the quality of the review is. It deserves an absolute standing O from beginning to end. Why don't we take a listen to Mr. Fieri's defense of his restaurant on the Today Show?
I just thought it was ridiculous. I mean, I've read reviews. You know, there's good and there's bad in the restaurant business. But that, to me, went so overboard. It really seemed like there was another agenda. Came in four times to a restaurant that's been open 2 months. That's tough times. And do we do it perfect? No. Are we striving to do it perfect? Yes. But that's what we're all doing in the business.
Dana, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, obviously, as a critic, I was just jealous of the review. It's just it's sort of a triumphant piece of rhetoric in that genre that it's in, of the absolute pan. What really struck me about the response to the review, though, is that so many people sort of stood up, not necessarily even on Guy Fieri's side, but sort of on the side of the savage subject of a critique. And there was a lot of discussion online, including among some really smart writers who I like, about whether this critique had gone too far and what is a negative review for, and if something is that awful, why are you reviewing it at all? And I thought it opened up some questions about criticism that were quite interesting.
Oh my God. Julia, what do you make of this? Do you think that beyond a degree of savagery, regardless of the quality of the thing under examination, a critic can go too far?
I think a critic can go too far if, for example, one of the most misunderstood things about the review, I think, was the notion that the New York Times is a snobby bastion of elitism, akin perhaps to the Quiet Car, and that why would a guy like Pete Wells even bother to review a restaurant from a guy like Guy Fieri? And I actually think if you read the review closely, it becomes clear that Pete Wells is sort of a fan of Guy Fieri's. I mean, Guy Fieri's brand on the Food Network is that he travels around the country on a show called Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, where he drives around the country and tries to highlight the best of kind of down-home street food, unpretentious, great American cuisine covered in, you know, molten lava of American cheese. And there's many delicious kinds of food to be found in that realm. And I think that's something that Pete Wells understands. I think part of why he was interested in reviewing this restaurant and going to it four times in the first 2 months, which, as far as I can tell, is what a restaurant critic is supposed to do. I was not clear on the nature of Guy Fieri's defense that it was preposterous for a critic to show up at an open restaurant multiple times in an effort to evaluate its quality.
Right. When else do you review a restaurant except when it opens? That's when people want to hear about it.
Yeah, you're supposed to wait 6 months to give them time to work out the kinks. They're supposed to work out the kinks before they open it. But anyway, I think that Pete Wells reviewed this restaurant because he thought he might like it and wanted to like it and is capable of appreciating a beautifully created plate of nachos. And he found Guy Fieri's nachos to be lacking. And then he said so very, very amusingly. So I think if I had read the review and felt that Pete Wells, there was no chance in hell that Pete Wells was ever going to like or give any kind of positive notice to this restaurant, then it would have seemed unsporting and cruel. But because it seemed like he gave it a shot and then was horrified by what he discovered, I found it incredibly entertaining.
I think also it's harder to feel sorry for Guy Fieri, given that he is this huge brand, right, and has so many restaurants and so many chains across the country and, as you say, multiple TV personalities. And so it's not as if it's sort of, you know, a little artisan crafting and working so hard at his restaurant and then having it knocked down by a snobby food critic. It seems like the restaurant was being cynically and sloppily run by a lot of underlings who weren't really responding to anyone. Mm-hmm.
Dana, you stole my thunder. Those are the two points I was going to make, which is if we're going to abstract the conversation out to what a critic's responsibility are vis-a-vis their own capacity for rhetorical savagery, I would say, you know, every critic probably is motivated. We're all large human beings and small human beings, and that part of us that is a critic is constantly striving to keep those two in balance because our own smallness is always in danger of leaping out of our mouth before we really think about it. That said, you know, sometimes someone gives you a huge opening to let your own inner Swift emerge. And two things I would say really should discipline the critic. The first is, you know, can the person that you're about to dole out on, can they take it? Are they not, for example, a first-time novelist or, you know, someone who's really going to be unknown other than your review? Like, if your review is what confers notoriety on something that's unworthy, I think you've participated in the aesthetic crime to some degree.
And this is to some degree why there is an argument to be made, as we recently discussed, Laura Miller of Salon Making, that if you're going to really trash the first book of a new writer, you shouldn't write about it at all.
You shouldn't write about it at all. Okay, so that's judgment number one. Then judgment number two is to the extent that we all are born with a quotient of volcanic rage, that we're looking for a really good, solid excuse to vent it out, to let it spew forth. What seems to me is implied by every sentence in that review is that this is an utterly cynical money-making venture, and this guy was slinging slop by virtue of his, to my mind, quite stupid television personality on Innocence. I think Pete Wells, public service all the way.
But you yourself just said you'd never seen him on TV. How can you say he's a stupid television personality?
Yeah, I don't know if you're being fair to Guy Fieri, Steve. I mean, I think you're adding fuel to the fire of people who say that snobs like to see a common man taken down. But I don't think that's what Pete Wells was doing. I have a question for Dana, though, which is, have you ever regretted something mean you've said in a review? Like, do you ever think you've crossed a line, or do you think there is a line to cross?
I know that I've toned down reviews when I sort of imagine the person reading them, and maybe the only time I regretted having been really harsh in a review was when I met the director of the movie that I had savaged at a party and was introduced to him. And I think he just heard that I worked for Slate. He didn't necessarily know that I was the movie critic. Or maybe he knew I was the movie critic, but he thought there were others or something. I know he just said something about, Slate did not give me a kind review. And I felt like there's no point in me lying. He's just going to go home and check the byline. So, you know, I think I said, yep, that was me. Oh, my cheeks are burning just thinking about it. What a horrible, horrible night.
No, you're an honest woman, Dana.
Never go to parties. That's the answer to that dilemma.
And the truth is, when you review, Dana, you're constantly over-consuming a particular kind of item way beyond the capacities for patience of a normal human being. And every now and then, one is going to bear the brunt of all of your built-up frustrations. And it's just the way it is.
Yeah, that happens with superhero movies with me sometimes. Sometimes an innocent one will happen along that's really not that terrible, but I'm just so sick of that kind of movie that I will unload on it a little bit.
I think I'm learning that I don't contain enough boiling rage to be a critic. I think that's what I've learned from this segment.
You would just sip down your nuclear waste margarita and...
Maybe. Or maybe if I were a critic, I would feel more boiling rage. Maybe that's the way it goes. That's probably true.
All right. Well, that review was titled As Not Seen on TV. It's Pete Wells' review of Guy Fieri's American Kitchen and Bar, Times Square theme restaurant. The review appeared in the New York Times. Check it out. Utterly hilarious. Coming up, noisy malefactors and silent snobs in Amtrak's quiet car. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. Two pieces of news arrived recently, and somewhat in tandem, if you thought about them for a second. The first was that the great American novelist Philip Roth, approaching the age of 80, has decided to retire from what he called the fanatical habit of writing. Philip Roth is best known for his early novels Goodbye Columbus and Portnoy's Complaint, and then had a – I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why this piece of news is so interesting, is that he then had one of the truly great and unexpected career resurgences in, I would argue, in the history of all of literature, not just American letters, when fairly late in midlife he produced the novels Sabbath Theater, The Human Stain, and most notably American Pastoral, one of the great American novels of the last 50 years. And then twinned with that is the 50th anniversary of the Rolling Stones, which the band used as an occasion to announce the fact that they would, yes, they would continue on, they would soldier on into their late 60s and early 70s and play a set of shows, play a tour. And this got us thinking about the whole notion of retirement. Which is better? Is it better to hang up your cleats while you still have something left or to leave it all out on the field? Is it better to leave an audience wanting more or to utterly exhaust them with your showmanship almost to the point of annoyance? Julia, what did you make of both of these? You sort of pick up wherever you want. What did you make of these two pieces of news? And did you kind of click them together like a couple of nickels and come up with some thoughts on the nature of retirement?
Thoughts on the Nature of Retirement by Julia Turner. Well, I guess my primary thought is that artists should do what makes them happy. I mean, I get that they're producing work for us to consume, and sometimes if people drag it out and produce continually less good work in their waning years, it could perhaps tar or mar their legacy. But I think artists who are thinking primarily about their work as a corpus and about their legacy according to the body of work that they have produced in total are lame brains, and that they should just do what, you know, whatever it is that drove them to make the art in the first place, they should follow that instinct. If Philip Roth was getting exhausted by the sheer level of effort it took him to construct those sentences and he felt like he didn't have any more things to say, which is what he told the New York Times, great, hang up your pen. And if the Rolling Stones feel like life would be sad if they can't get up on a stage and writhe around in leather looking like freaky doll puppets, then go ahead, freak it away.
Right, and charge $500 a ticket, you know, for the privilege of seeing it. I guess I sort of side with Julia on this one, Dana. Are you slightly more skeptical about this? Is a certain kind of decorous late life reticence maybe the way to go? And it maybe does help your legacy in the long run not to have spoiled an image of what you were like in your prime.
I really agree with Julia that it is radically up to the artist. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have someone like Quentin Tarantino, who recently released some kind of, to me, bravado-filled and maybe not true statement about how he's going to retire after a few more movies because no director has ever made – the last four movies of every director have been terrible, and he wants to retire while he's still in the game. And it seemed to me, Julia – a lot like what you were just talking about the very small-minded artist who's always kind of grooming his legacy as opposed to just thinking about whether or not he has anything to say.
Well, I also think that the idea that Quentin Tarantino will somehow not have a final four movies whenever he stops is false. Like whatever
his
last
maybe
four
the
movies
final
will
four
remain his
started.
Last four movies. And so if his theory is that those are bad, they will still be bad. Yeah, I did once go see the Rolling Stones play at Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. A friend of mine in college had tickets, and we went, and it was a ridiculous and pathetic spectacle. I mean, it was like all sorts of people my parents' age, like getting high and shrieking while these like little old man puppets danced in a manner that was not becoming, but seemed like they thought it was becoming because it had at one point been becoming. Mm-hmm. And they were completely stringy and unappealing and looked like weirdos. But, you know, and some of their songs were great and some of them were not. And, you know, I'm a big fan of their music. But, you know, I think for musicians, the performance aspect of it is different, perhaps, than for some other art forms. Like if you're a writer or you're a director, you are not in the moment connecting directly with the consumers of whatever the art is you're producing. Whereas performing a live show and feeling that kind of adulation and adoration from the audience must be its own kind of artistic rush and connection that might be harder to let go of, or why not share it with those people if you can still get, you know, a bunch of Dylan heads to come to Barclays Stadium? Why not invite them and see who comes out?
You know what? You know the way it breaks down for me. I think a couple different things. The first is that I think if you're more like on the Sandy Koufax model. I mean, Koufax, once he really arrived as a pitcher, pitched five of the truly greatest seasons in a row that a pitcher has ever had, and then hung it up right when he was quite young. Or if you're more like, you know, someone like maybe, you know, Joyce, who writes one kind of novel, a book of short stories, then another kind of novel, a kind of long novella, and then he writes Ulysses, and then he writes the all-time greatest kind of language-consuming work of art ever created, Finnegan's Wake, and then he's done, right? And there's something about the self-contained career in which every act appears in retrospect to be perfectly volitional, as opposed to the purely productive model of, oh, writing is what I do when I get up in the morning, so I guess I won't stop.
Sort of, and, like Woody Allen. I feel like Woody Allen's right. filmmaking is essentially that. I make films. I make a film a year. They don't all have to be great. It's what I do. And a part of me admires that, even though I'm not interested in his films.
A part of me admires that too, Dana. But I think the important thing to point out is that, first of all, I think it's very heavily a baby boomer phenomenon, right? In part because the audience is hungry for these icons that they were familiar with starting at an early age, and they'll continue to consume them until they die. They, the baby boomers, die. So as long as Woody Allen is breathing, as long as Mick Jagger is breathing, and Dylan, we're going to get product from them. But what I would say is, in favor of the artist who decides to hang it up while they are still great, the thing that they get is less tangible than the money the Stones are obviously getting, the billions of dollars the Stones are going to get, you know, by doing tours like this. What they get is they get the right to consume their own posterity as a utility in their own lifetime. Sandy Koufax is still alive and is treated as a kind of god when he goes around to the Grapefruit League ballparks, because he did something, I think people, you know, in the world of sports are conscious of the fact he did something quite beautiful in those 5 years and then left it alone. I mean, the young Rolling Stones were just miraculous, and all they've done is they've fed off of that. I mean, I cherish albums they made up through the 1970s, but good God, it's now been 30 years since they've done anything even remotely relevant. They could have been treated as gods in their own lifetime, as opposed to a bunch of pathetic old grannies who don't know when it's time to stop.
But I guess the question is, do you value that? I mean, the classic counterexample from television is Seinfeld, right? Seinfeld was a great show. It had huge ratings. It was still finding interesting stories to mine and doing its Seinfeldian thing. And they decided to pull the plug on it at the height of its powers. But none of them has really found a terrific career afterwards, and it makes me sad for them a little bit that this thing that they enjoyed and were so good at went away. You know, I think Julia Louis-Dreyfus is the only one who's found continued repeated success on television, and everyone else has sort of had sporadic weird projects. I mean, Jerry Seinfeld is driving around in luxury cars making comics go out for coffee with him.
If it is the case that the Seinfeld show ended because Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David just wanted to go out on a high note, then I think that is an example of maybe retiring a little bit too early, and that Jerry Seinfeld's current career seems like a classic case of somebody who still has energy but doesn't know what to do with it and maybe left what he was doing too early.
Yeah, but then to argue against my own point, I mean, I guess I just don't care that the Rolling Stones have become lame. Mm-hmm. Like, if the Rolling Stones want to be lame, that's fine. If people want to go watch them play their old songs, that seems fine too. Like, it doesn't seem to me to diminish what they accomplished at the height of their powers that they're being lame-os now.
All right, well, I got to go around the table. Dana, 2030, still a culture gap fest?
Just the nostalgia tour.
Yeah. Oh, really?
In our too tight pleather pants.
Will we just talk about old topics? We'll have like a spinning roulette wheel in Havana, and we'll go back and we'll talk about Jerry Seinfeld's webisodes.
I think we'll still be talking about irony, the role of the critic, and the future of print culture.
And Justin Bieber, President Justin Bieber.
And President Justin Bieber. On that note, we're a tribe, we quiet ones. We readers and thinkers and letter writers. We daydreamers and gazers out of windows. We are a civil people, courteous to excess, who disdain displays of anger as childish and embarrassing. The quiet car is our territory. I'm quoting the words of Tim Kreider, a writer for the New York Times who rides on the quiet car on Amtrak, and he feels as though the modern world has exploded into a panoply of discourteous noise. And for him, the quiet car is a kind of redoubt for those of us who are more contemplative, who are capable of nuanced turns of thought. Do you agree with this assessment?
I love Quiet Steve.
You've never met Quiet Car Steve before? Quiet Car Steve is asking a question. Could you please stop laughing? That's discourteous. Could you laugh away from the microphone at least? We have listeners who are in quiet cars right now. Dana. And also, by the way, that orange shirt is a little loud for the quiet car.
Can I ask, before we get into discussing this piece, this defense/ode to the quiet car, whether you guys have ridden in the quiet car?
I rode in the quiet car this morning to come to New York City from Hudson, New York.
Well, you two are much more Amtrak users than I am, since, Julia, you're always hopping up and down the East Coast for something or other, and Steve lives on the train, basically. So the Quiet Car, to me, is more of a place of myth.
Well, okay, but here's – okay, I rode the Quiet Car this morning. It does seem to me you're faced with a choice, which Kreider's piece gets at, which is you either are in the not quiet car, in which case most interactions are normal but annoying or annoying but normal, or you're in the quiet car, in which case, you know, this horrible – you know, there's just a reserve of anger and recrimination waiting to be provoked by the first person who tip-taps too loudly on their laptop. Julia, what – I mean, would you ever ride in the quiet car?
I'm a regular rider of the quiet car, which for people who are not Amtrak riders and have a slim grasp of the English language, it is a car on Amtrak trains where you have to be very quiet. But the thing that's unusual about it is that it's really enforced, and it's enforced by the tribe of quiet car riders, because it's not speak quietly. It's not only answer one cell phone call. It's literally don't talk. Don't listen to your headphone volume loud. It's a very quiet public space. And I find it's a good place to get work done if I've got to do some edits on the train ride. You never can tell when you're going to get sat next to somebody who's having a series of big, important conference calls and is blathering away behind you in the normal slash loud cars. And so, I like it. But I do think it's like a psychological test, because I think it raises the question in you, what sort of quiet car enforcer are you going to be? Will you simply be a silent enjoyer of the quiet car and count on people sterner than you to yell at transgressors and shame them into silence? Or are you a silence shamer yourself? I think I've been both on different trips.
But Julia, here's the real question, right? And Dana, this is the real question is, so the piece, we all agree having a quiet car is a nice public service and that people should respect its rules, and if they're if you want it and not if you don't. Okay, fine. The thing about Kreider's piece is that there's this unmistakable quiet car tone to the whole thing, a kind of holy hush over it. And then it lapses into that, you know, outright sanctimony that you heard at the top of the segment. I mean, Dana, right, even gentle quiet car Dana, right, doesn't that just grind your teeth to hear that tone?
Absolutely. I was jealous of his ride in the quiet car until he got to that We the Dreamers business. And then I realized with a jolt that this was Tim Kreider, the same New York Times op-ed writer who wrote a piece that we discussed months ago, I think, called The Busy Trap, that had a similar sort of I am more zen than thou kind of pose about how everyone's so busy. And if only we could stop being so busy and just sit and appreciate a flower, as I can do in my life by traveling to the south of France or something like that. Do you remember that piece? And I think it had that same sort of – there's something basically true about it. There's something basically true about the fact that we're all living in an absurd cacophony and that we're all overly busy. But there's a hostility in this kind of corrective journalism that does great.
For some reason, I thought he balanced the tone better in this piece. I thought there was a bit of wry self-amusement in this piece at the hauteur of the quiet car aficionados that I did not find in the Busy Trap piece. But now that you've linked the bylines of the two pieces together, maybe I'm just going to think less of the quiet car piece.
I'm on my way after we record this segment to a Quaker meeting at my child's school, because it's a Thanksgiving sing and everybody sits in silence for a few minutes before the kids sing. And that is one of the few times in my daily life that I get to sit in a completely quiet room with no demands being placed on me. And though I'm not a Quaker, I just think it's a great experience that everybody should try to have just once. It's a quiet car of a church.
Hear. All right. Well, that piece once again is called The Quiet Ones, and it's in the New York Times. It's by Tim Kreider. Check it out. All right. Well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Well, if you love to look at cute animals, but you're too embarrassed to spend your day on BuzzFeed looking through lists of the 10 cutest baby wombats, and you just find it too humiliating that you're always looking for cute animals, then I have the show for you. There's an episode of Nature, PBS's Nature, great show in general, called Odd Couples that aired a couple of weeks ago. You can watch the whole thing online now. And it's all about animals from different species who are friends. so with the scientific backing,
I've never heard you use that voice,
Dana. Oh, the voice is going to get worse as I describe the show.
It's quiet car viewing.
So with the endorsement of Temple Grandin and other well-known animal scientists talking about animal behavior and do animals experience emotions and so forth, you can clothe yourself in the dignity of that framework while you watch a duck who's bonded to a tortoise and follows the tortoise everywhere, an old goat and an old horse, very, very old animals. The horse has gone blind, and the goat now leads him everywhere he goes and leads him to his favorite pasture to graze in. What are some other wonderful ones? Oh, monkeys riding on dogs' backs. I mean, you can just coo your way into oblivion watching Odd Couples on PBS's Nature.
Is this a cartoon or live action?
No, it's live action and it's all real. It's so fantastic to watch these animals interact because there's no posing. It's not somebody putting a bow on their dog's head and putting it in a pumpkin. It's actually a dog and a cheetah who are brought up together as siblings.
Oh, my God.
And they snuggle in a pile.
This is sanatorium viewing here. I love it. Julia, what do you got?
I'm amazed. I'm still stunned and shell-shocked by that endorsement. All right. My endorsement for the week, it is the time of year when I commence my annual knitting project. It is knitting season. It is time to start making a hat or a scarf or something or other. I recently started a hat and have mastered brioche stitch, which I'm very proud of and excited about. But as a part of discovering this and trying to figure out how the hell the brioche stitch works, because the pattern I had was not forthcoming on that point, I signed up for something I'd read about on Slate several months ago, which is the social networking site Ravelry, which is a social networking site for knitters and crocheters, people who crochet. I'm not sure what the noun is. I don't crochet. And it is an amazing resource. It is a really cool social network. If you knit and are not on it, you should join it. And if you knit and are on it, you should holler at me on the Facebook page so I can befriend you and see your patterns and your yarn stash. But the thing I really like about it is that it's like social networking paired with utility is not something I'm accustomed to. And it actually seems great. It makes me wonder why there are not social networking sites for gardeners and social networking sites for... Well, I guess there are social networking sites for people who just want to look at videos of cute animals making friends. But anyway, Ravelry.com, join it, or if you are on it, holler at me and let me know.
That sounds cool. Okay, Julia, I have a question for you. Do you have a favorite song about premature ejaculation? I've been meaning to ask you that for a while.
I'm sure you have. I'm not sure I've yet arrived at an answer.
Okay, well, I have one for you. I'm convinced that the song may prove me wrong. Email me or go to the Facebook page and tell me I'm crazy. But the Ryan Adams, I don't love Ryan Adams. Don't get me wrong, but he has a couple of absolutely awesome songs. One of which is called Firecracker, and I swear to God, it is a kind of hymn to that activity, which I'm actually unfamiliar with personally, but I've read about. on the internet. And tell me I'm wrong. I think that's what that song is about. It's a great rock and roll tune. Maybe we'll go out on it. But if you listen to the lyrics, I am sure that's what he's hymning to in that song.
Can I just speak up in defense of Ryan Adams as a songwriter? I think he is an absolutely brilliant songwriter who writes way too many songs. I think embedded in his overly prolific output are three or four incredible classics.
Yeah, I completely agree. All right. Thank you, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving, you guys.
Oh, yeah. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, chow down.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's show at wnyc.org/gabfest. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows in the iTunes store. Just search for Slate Podcasts. Our email address is gabfestradio@slate.com. Gabfest Radio is a production of slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Mike Voilo and Dan Pashman. Our interns are Jeff Friedrich and Sally Tamarkin. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For David Plotz and the rest of the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf, and we'll see you next week.